Okay, at the end of class, I'll give you the prompts and the official assignment for your midterm. You do 2 weeks from today. But of course, you've already had the assignment from day one, because there's no official questions you need to answer. You just need to perform. Okay, let's get through Nietzsche. I'm going to stop babbling. Let's get through this, because we don't have a lot of time before the break and before you be thinking about your midterm. So let's dive back into this. And I do want to read all the way through it. His argument is complex. And it's what makes it particularly complex is the fact that his position, his ethos, and his the stand he takes towards the things he's saying. You'll think you get master of his argument, but then the question will be, what is the status of what he said? Right? So, for instance, he will spend the whole first half of this essay telling us that we can never get truth. We can never get truth. It's all a failure. It's all a failure. That's, in fact, not what he's saying. He's saying, who cares about the truth? From whence truth? Right? He's making a very different argument. He's not talking about truth's inaccessibility. He's talking about the effects of arguing for truth. All right, so let's read this. We talked about the title, On Truth and Lies in a Non-Moral Sense, that in that one phrase already, he has proliferated the senses of truth. Right? He's already given multiple perspectives on truth, on the one thing that you think would be set, the one thing that seems to be univocal. All of a sudden, he's made multivocal. Right? And it begins with a myth. And I've asked you, hopefully you've reread this, and you see by the end that he argues for the very status of myth, argues that myth comes first, that man is fundamentally a metaphoric creature, a mythological creature. We have a will to myth. A will to myth precedes a will to truth. Right? And the will to myth for him is a, if he has any kind of hierarchy, the will to myth precedes exceeds and supersedes the will to truth, right? The will to myth, right? The will to create, the will to mythology, the will to art. So he begins with a myth, and that is of note, right? And then he tells us that knowing was invented, and it was the most arrogant and mendacious moment of world history, but nevertheless, it was only a minute. After nature had drawn a few breaths, the star cooled and congealed, and the clever beasts had to die. One might invent such a fable, and yet he still would not have adequately illustrated how miserable, how shadowy and transient, how aimless and arbitrary the human intellect looks within nature. There were eternities during which it did not exist. This is such a good move, and this is a common move to the rhetor, right? And to texts that we've read, right? Bart does it with the author. Make the thing that seems like it's outside of time. Take the thing that you take for granted just as true and universal, and give it a history. So Nietzsche will do that in his probably his greatest, most thorough book. It's called On the Genealogy of Morals. And he's like, let's just trace the history of morality. Morality is not a given. Let's just trace from when it comes, from whence it comes. And he traces all the way back to, like, he makes up this whole elaborate mythology about early man and the evolution of the species, trying to track where this thing comes from, because it's not a given. Bart does it with the author, right? These things you take for granted have history. Right? The most probably famous examples all come from what I wrote on the board the other day, Michel Foucault, who did a whole series of histories, history of madness, a history of sexuality. We assume we know what sexuality is, but he argues no. It's historical. It's specific to time and place. What one person calls sexuality is very different from what another person calls sexuality. And he traces it. Nietzsche, in this essay, performs perhaps the most radical move and says truth has a history. Knowing itself has a history. Right? So there are times at which truth didn't exist, knowledge didn't exist, and then it comes into being. And he asks, from whence this thing truth?
Okay. And it's also interesting how, as opposed to just one singular eternity, he puts eternities like plural.
Very good. It's another good catch, right? So guy's pointing out that he says eternities. Just as in the beginning, he talks about numberless twinkling solar systems, he talks about that universe. Notice the constant will to multiplicity. We saw it in Quinault, we saw it in Disologoi. Notice it here in Nietzsche, right from the get-go. Numberless twinkling solar systems, that universe. That means there are more than one universe. It's unbelievable, right? Universe, you would think, is uni, is one. But now he's made many. For this intellect has no additional mission which would lead it beyond human life. Rather, it is human and is only and only its possessor and begetter takes it so solemnly, as though the world's axis turned within it. But if we could communicate with the gnat, we would learn that he likewise flies through the air with the same solemnity, that he feels the flying center of the universe within himself. This is the beautiful moment where he's, rather than decentering the world, he's made everything the center. And so he gives us a very different world, right? Because rather than a world that goes towards community, right, in which we all share a center, we all go around the sun, he's made everybody the sun. Think how that would shift how you approach argument. If everybody's the center. If you're talking to someone, you assume that they, what they're saying, according to them, is true, then how you approach them is going to change rather dramatically. Right? When you're in any negotiation, what you know to be true, the other person might take fundamentally as not true. They might have a fundamentally different truth. Right? And think about how then you speak. How can you speak to someone who thinks something else is true? Okay, and we'll talk about this in more detail soon. We'll talk about medicine because I'm very, very interested in the way, in this proliferation of what's so-called alternative medicine. And I pursue many of these things. I see a Chinese doctor, traditional Chinese doctor, as well as a homeopath, as well as an MD, and it's very interesting the way they can possibly speak to each other. And we'll talk about it in some detail, because they have fundamentally different discourses about what counts as true. To the Western MD, it's just true. You have a virus. Homeopath, there's no such thing as a virus to a homeopath. It literally is nonsense. It's literally insane. It's insane. Tell a homeopathic doctor, I have a virus. They're like, well, what's a virus? They don't even know what that is. It means nothing to them. It's a very different truth they operate in. And we'll drill down a little bit into that. Homeopathy is the future, man. Right? Western medicine, the so-called medical profession, it will crumble. It's crumbling quickly and will bring most of Western civilization down with it, as it already is. It is an unbelievable failure. It's what happens when you leave it to the free market. Anyway. I'll stop with that rant. Right? There is nothing so reprehensible and unimportant in nature that it would not immediately swell up like a balloon at the slightest puff of this power of knowing. And then he stops and he says, okay, it is remarkable that this pomposity, all the effects of this thing was brought on by the intellect, which was certainly allotted to these most unfortunate, delicate, and ephemeral beings merely as a device for detaining them a minute within existence. Right? It's amazing, right? So watch how he, again, decenters the human. Any thought about the human and the human's claims to knowledge, right, as being superior, progressive beings for its knowledge, look what he does here. It's like, oh my God, he's flabbergasted. He's flabbergasted that the intellect has done this thing. Right, that this intellect, which was just given to people so they could live for another minute because they're so weak and sort of ill-equipped for this life. We'll talk about that in more detail. The pride connected with knowing and sensing lies like a blinding fog over the eyes and senses of men, thus deceiving them concerning the value of existence. And this is precisely what is at stake. If you ask, so what? So what? Why are we doing this? Why does Nietzsche proliferate these worlds? Why are you giving us this psychedelic world coffee? And why are you giving us this insane, constant will to multiplicity? It's because we're addressing the value of existence. Right? Nietzsche says, right, that when we have this thing called knowing, and with it he's going to argue that there's morality, that knowing and morality are one and the same. They come from the same place. Right? And I hope you caught that, right? That the will to truth is really just is a moral code, and that knowledge, the scientist and the priest, really come from the same place. They're really not so different, right? That we think that there's a big dichotomy between science and religion, and Nietzsche's like, no, same thing. Why? Because you both think you know. Right? Right. So, what is the value of existence? Why are we here? What's the point? Nietzsche is going to talk about existence as a value, almost in the sense of a charge, of an electric charge. that rather than living here to know, to accumulate more, to finally command the world and maybe achieve some kind of, I don't know what, you know so much that you know the same amount as God and then you become divine. What is the will to know? What is its goal? When you want to know the truth of something versus experiencing, knowing its charge, experiencing its charge. What is the value of existence? There's an essay in here, I don't think we'll ever get to in the reader, called So What? You might want to take a peek at. And we'll talk again and again about why this insane worldview? Why not just sit tight and believe in truth and argument and go to your little debate clubs and, you know, debate abortion and go vote and do all this nonsense, right? Why do all these things? Why listen to one word insane caffeine is telling you? So what? We'll come back to that. But this is what Nietzsche's saying this knowing blinds us to the value of existence itself. What Nietzsche's going to argue is that people who believe in knowledge and people who believe in God don't actually value existence. Nietzsche's great move, his boldest move maybe, is to say that those who believe in God are nihilists. Those who believe in knowledge are nihilists. That they try to skip over experience. To try to get at some abstraction, some not here. Something that's not here. They try to evade and avoid life. And for Nietzsche, the free intellect, and you'll see this at the end of the essay, he says it very quickly, but it becomes an argument throughout his philosophy. That this free intellect, that this other way of going, affirms life, enjoys life itself. That to the Judeo-Christians and to the scientists, something is wrong with this life. Think of the scientist who thinks he needs to find knowledge by going to a lab that effaces as much of life as possible. I'll make a vacuum. That's where I'll find truth. What is more nihilistic than that? Knowledge exists in the place nothing can happen in. That's nowhere. That's why Nietzsche calls it nihilism. It is a will to nothing. The white lab is a will to nothing, is a will to death. Not even to death, but to nothing. It's a good distinction, the will to nothing versus the will to death, because the will to death can be beautiful and life-affirming, right? Like the samurai who commits harikari, right? Rather than leading a stupid fucking life, right? Rather than being captured and taken down by the man, they gut themselves. Right? And there's something beautiful about that. I don't really understand it, but I'm terribly intrigued by it. Right? And it seems affirmative to me. They affirm themselves in suicide. But the person who goes to a white lab, that, you know, get rid of everything, put on gloves, put on a hat, put on a mask, no breath, right? None of me will touch the world. Nothing can come in here. Suck all the air out of it. Nietzsche looks and he's like, what will is this? What do you value in existence? Clearly nothing. You're trying to suck everything out of life. I highly recommend you reading Lucretius. Did I talk about Lucretius the other day? Lucretius on the nature of things, on the nature of the universe, where you get a very different science, right? You get a science based on palpability, based on experience. He's like, here, have some honey. You have honey. Goes, see, the atoms in honey, they're round. Can't you tell? Here, have something bitter. Right? The atoms are hooked. How do you know? Because it's on your tongue. Rather than seeking knowledge outside of life, what Lucretius does is fold knowledge into life itself. And that's what Nietzsche is doing here. As a means for the preserving of the individual, the intellect unfolds its principal powers into simulation, which is the means by which weaker, less robust individuals preserve themselves, since they have been denied the chance to wage the battle for existence with horns or with sharp teeth of beasts of prey. The intellect, then, is just a tool, right? If a cheat is fast, right? If, I watch a lot of dinosaur videos for obvious reasons, right? If the Allosaurus or something has big freaking claws and can gut you. What do we got? Look at us. We're not fast. Right? We're not particularly, our claws suck. Our teeth are not very strong. We don't have all that much going for us. Right? We would be exterminated really quickly. But somehow this little mutation happened and we got this thing called intellect. Right? We're clever. Right? So, you know, the big dinosaur is coming. I can go inside my house. Right? That's what keeps us alive. And again, Nietzsche's moving us down to a species level. He's broken the distinction, the rigid distinction that would separate man per se from animal. He says, okay, we're both animals. Now what happens? What kind of animal is man? So in this world of war man on man, what is it? A bellum omni contra omnes, war of all against all, every man for himself, right? Which again is a little bit of a mythology he creates, right? But there's a state of nature, and everyone's fighting everybody else, right? And you know there's a whole sort of bestiary of animals. Man is one of those animals, right? And how do we survive? This thing called intellect, right? Is a means for preserving the intellect. And what's its main tool? How does the intellect really, what's its main function? To lie. Right? It unfolds its principal powers in dissimulation. Right? In deception. That's what the intellect is. It's a tool of deception. Right? We can be clever. We can lay traps. Right? How many other animals lay traps?
Spiders.
Who does?
Spiders.
Spiders lay traps?
I don't know. And he draws a parallel between
men
and spiders.
Oh, see, there we go. Spiders. Good, good, good. And he draws this parallel between man and spiders. Yeah. I have to think about the trap. The trap is you know, we can be really sneaky. That's what we do. That's how we survive, because we're sneaky. Now, what's going to be really tricky about this essay is that you don't want to be sucked into thinking that Nietzsche is poo-pooing the intellect for this. Right? Nietzsche is going to say, you know what? Our principal powers of intellect do lie in dissimulation, but you know what? That's good. That's going to be the non-moral sense. From the moral sense, we're liars. From the non-moral sense, we're artists. That's going to be his move. So when it looks at the beginning that he's coming down and he's sort of it sounds like he's using the intellect and as a constant sort of pejorative. But he doesn't. He digs it. He likes being human. He's like, yeah, we got this thing that allows us to dissimulate. That's what we do. We as humans, we dissimulate. So let's dissimulate all the time. Right? Where do we get this will to truth? If our very means of survival on this planet is deception. He's like, that's why he's flabbergasted. How did we even get this will to truth? And the very thing that keeps us alive is our ability to lie. Creatively. And to lie creatively, right? So he's gonna, that's the move, that's the shape of this essay. Right? He comes in from a moral perspective. From a moral perspective, the intellect is a liar. But then he's gonna shift to the non-moral perspective and say it's not a liar. Because to call it a liar is to be a moralist. But he's not a moralist. So from a non-moral perspective, this thing, the intellect that dissimulates, is a means of creation, is a creative impulse, is the will to mythology, is the will to art, is the will to create. This art of dissimulation reaches its peak in man, deception, flattering, lying, deluding, talking behind the back, putting up false front, living in borrowed splendor, wearing a mask, hiding behind convention, playing a role for others and for oneself. Is so much the rule and the law among men that there is almost nothing which is less comprehensible than how an honest and pure drive for truth could have arisen among them. It's so complicated what he's doing here, right? Because what would honesty then be? Right? He uses this kind of moral language, like honesty and truth, but then throws it back on the moralists who believe in truth. Right? And his whole his ethos of shock. Of disbelief is so hilarious, right? Because he takes, again, the one thing we take so for granted. I just want to know stuff and know whether it's true. And he's like, oh my God, that's insane, right? So he takes the thing you think is familiar and he defamiliarizes it, right? He makes you an alien to yourself. Right? And a lot of the texts we're looking at will do that. And that's a good thing to do. Right? That's the fatigue showing. They are deeply immersed in illusions and in dream images. Their eyes merely glide over the surface of things and see forms. Their senses nowhere lead to truth. On the contrary, they're content to receive stimuli and then grope on the back of things. Okay? Now again, it's very complicated how he is saying this. Because he's saying, this is true, everything he says here, according to him, right? He doesn't change his argument. He changes the tone of his argument and the value of existence. So from a moral perspective, this argument he's making is horrible. It's his horrible realization, right? We're only groping on the backs of things. We're just gliding over. All we see are forms, right? We're immersed in dreams. But then he's going to turn by the end and say, yeah, the Athenians live in a dream world. Dreams are good. Celebrate dreams. Rather than seeing dreams as a problem, make all of life a dream. Separate the rigid distinction between dreams and waking. Right? If we imagine dreams and waking as being sort of bifurcated along the lines of rationality and irrationality, and Nietzsche's like, no. Right? It's not that when you're waking, you're conscious, and you know things. When you're asleep is when the crazy things happen. Nietzsche's like, no, crazy shit all the time. Right? And so here he's talking about we're all living in dream world, and he's saying it sort of negatively. He's only saying it negatively from a moral perspective. Right? By the end, he's going to be privileging this dream life. Moreover, man permits himself to be deceived in his dreams every night of his life. His moral sentiment does not even make an attempt to prevent this, whereas there are supposed to be men who have stopped snoring through sheer willpower. He's saying, you know, if you were really interested in rationality and in knowing, you would stop your wacky dreams. But the fact is, man still enjoys his dreams. We enjoy the wackiness of our dreams. He's saying, that's right. We enjoy them. That's our will. That is what makes us human. And that's okay. That's a good thing. Right? So he's trying to show that this will to knowledge, this will to truth is not so fixed on itself even. Right? That it has this kind of these gaps in its own logic, right? In its own life. It lets itself dream. If you really were interested in rationality, you'd stop your nutty dreams. People can stop snoring with the willpower. Why can't you stop your nutty dreaming? Oh, because you like dreaming. Oh, because you're not actually interested in truth. That's his argument here. Is he indeed ever able to perceive himself completely as if laid out in a lighted display case? It's a nice moment there, right? The lighted display case is itself the weird vehicle of science that he's critiquing, right? So here again, he uses the language and figures of the very thing he's critiquing, right? So he's saying, you think you know yourself? Are you laid out in the case just like you think you lay the world out in a display case? Like at a museum? Like in a science lab? Nope. All right? So again, it's rhetorically very subtle and complex what he's doing here, right? Co-opting the language of the thing he's arguing against. Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you ever read like Bertolt Brecht. I'm sure you have. But like, it's kind of interesting. It reminds me of like the same language he uses in his essay on Peter, or the New Peter.
I never read one word of Bertolt Brecht, I have to tell you.
Specifically, he talks about like lighted. The essay is really about like it's a new type of theater, specifically isolating, like alienating, like the character from the actor, and really putting it like on the spotlight or whatever. Yeah. But anyway, I just felt like it's kind of parallel.
Well, Nietzsche is also probably the most influential writer. It's a terrible word because I don't really know what that means, but his impact is felt rather dramatically through probably every 20th century writer. It's probably safe to say, based on nothing, because I've never really read anything. And you know the Nazis loved them, right? You know the Nazis were crazy for the Nietzsche, even though Nietzsche was so hated the Germans and the anti-Semites more than anything. Anyway, not a big fan of the Jews either. Okay, so he's like, all right, given this insane situation, right? This, nature threw away the the key and woe to the fatal curiosity which might one day have the power to peer out and down through a crack in the chamber of consciousness and then suspect that man is sustained in the indifference of his ignorance by that which is pitiless, greedy, insatiable, and murderous. Given this situation, where in the world could the drive for truth have come from? That is the nasty performative argument he makes, right? Again, that truth becomes something that is a drive, and that comes from somewhere, has a history. It's not automatic. And he's going to make a very specific historical argument by the end of this and say that after the Greco-Romans, truth was not the goal. They privileged beauty, strength, pleasure. And he's going to argue whether this is true or not. It doesn't matter, because truth itself is the thing he's arguing against. But he creates this mythology, right? He creates this argument. And it says, you know, there was a time, a specific time, at which this will to truth really emerges and really takes hold culturally. It might date back before Judeo-Christianity, but then it's when it really takes hold. And we see the beginnings of the fall of a mythological culture, an artistic culture. You see the rise of science, knowledge. Insofar as the individual wants to maintain himself against other individuals, he will, under natural circumstances, employ the intellect mainly for dissimulation. Again, this whole thing, knowledge, the intellect, the ability to think, it's a defense mechanism. It's a vehicle of war. It's a vehicle of battle. But, and this is why Nietzsche is so freaking good. At the same time, from boredom and necessity, man wishes to exist socially and with the herd. It's such an unbelievably hilarious sentence. All right, so first of all, the herd. That's a refrain through all of Nietzsche, right? He has a fair amount of disdain for community, right? For the collectivity, the herd. Right? But watch how he sees it at a specie level. Right? We're just animals, and we want to live like a herd, like a little pack. Right? But look at the beginning of this. At the same time, from boredom and necessity. What a great combination. Boredom. Boredom. From boredom, man. We use the intellect for other things out of boredom. Sure, we use it mostly to protect ourselves, to be clever. You know, the dinosaur is going to come and eat us. I know it wasn't actually a dinosaur, but the dinosaurs, it's okay. The dinosaur is going to come and eat us, right? So what do? I plant a trap, right? I'm clever. That's how I survive. But how else do I use the intellect? Well, I get bored. I start inventing shit because I'm bored. And necessity, right? So all these things, and he's going to argue at the end of this, in the beginning of the second section, he's going to go, this will to metaphor, that all truth ever is metaphor, this will to metaphor is necessary. That's what we do. It's impossible to be human and not use metaphors. It's not a problem to him. It's a necessity. The problem to him is that people come along, use these metaphors, and think they have the truth. That's the problem. So it's not the dissimulation that's the problem. It's the thought and the pride, the arrogance, and the effects that we'll get into of saying that this lie is true. Right? That's what pisses him off. That's what he's arguing against. That's what he's trying to take down. Right? So when you feel his kind of, what's the word? His venom. His venom is not against metaphor. It's not against dissimulation. That's him speaking as a moralist. That's a faux position. His venom is against the pride of the person who makes something up. Like a beautiful, like, again, the person to me who goes into a vacuum, drops a bowling ball and a feather, I want to see that in an art show. That's beautiful. I dig it. But the person who says that's what truth is, and fuck you, all the people who don't believe it, well, that person's a vindictive prick, right? And we got to take that person down. Because now that person is trying to say, control how we speak. That person is trying to say, I didn't just make something beautiful. I made something that's true, and that thing that you made over there, can't do it. It's illegal. You're lying. Right? That's what he's pissed off about. That's where his anger is coming from. Right? Therefore, he needs to make peace and strives accordingly to banish from this world at least the most flagrant bellum omni contra omnes. The peace treaty brings in its wake something which appears to be the first step towards acquiring that puzzling truth drive, right? To wit, which shall count as truth from now on is established. Okay, so to make a peace treaty, he has this sort of mythology of everybody fighting everybody else, right? The sort of state of nature. Does that sound familiar? Right, it kind of sort of comes out of, I don't know, pre-Enlightenment, right? Rousseau and these cats, right? Hobbes. Right? There's a certain kind of a familiar trope. There's a state of nature. Everyone's killing everybody else. Right, the sort of all of Western political systems are built on this premise that we all left the state of nature and signed a contract. And that's why we have laws. We give government to police our instincts to kill each other. Right, that's what our Constitution is. Right. And our entire legal system. Not all legal systems are like that, but that is ours. So he says, okay, so in order to get a little peace, because you know what? This state of nature, when you're kind of a weak little intellect, is tiring. It's tiring. Right? I'm not strong and fast. The cheetah has no need for the intellect. It has no need for these treaties. Or the mountain lion. I know more about the mountain lion. I have great respect for the mountain lion. Do you know about mountain lions? Besides being, you know, local to us? I saw one once up at Point Reyes. Walked right by me. It was unbelievable. I wouldn't even have noticed, except I was with a dog, and the dog's head turned. And so I turned, because I'm an idiot, and I'm like, oh, look, there's the biggest cat I have ever seen. And it's huge, walking quietly. Unbelievable. One mountain lion, and the reason why mountain lions come down and kill us sometimes, because one mountain lion occupies 50 square miles. Right? One mountain lion. You fuck with his territory, he smells you out and kills you, right? And so the weaker ones get pushed out, and they get pushed into our cities and, you know, into Sacramento, God knows why, right? They're loners. They have no need, right? They have no need to get this community. One mountain lion, think about it. You see a mountain lion, he lives his entire life. He comes in once in a while, gets a little action, so to speak, you know, and then gets out of there, right? Mama raises the kids alone. Daddy's up in the mountaintop all alone. Once a year, comes down for action. It's a beautiful, intense, very non-human life, right? So he's like, but humans were weak, petty little things, and it's scary out there. That mountain lion's hunting us. So let's make a treaty. Let's all get together, man. A, it's kind of boring running around all the time, and B, I think we'll survive better. Necessity, right? So if we're all going to live together, let's create this thing called truth. Right? And what is it? Well, a uniformly valid and binding designation is invented for things, and the legislation of language likewise establishes the first laws of truth. For the contrast between truth and lies arises for the first time. So truth, according to Nietzsche, in this sort of history of truth, is not that some noble thing about trying to capture, you know, I don't even know what it would be. I don't even know what the will to truth even is. I'm going to know the world. It was something built out of convenience, boredom and necessity, and it's a rule of language. It's simply what can we say and what can't we say. That's what truth is. Truth is a result of language and about what's allowed to be said and not be said. If you say that, that's okay. But you can't say these things. It is a law. It is a law of language. And again, this is what, for those who care, and I highly recommend reading, and you will read again, by Foucault, even more than Nietzsche, ties the rhetoric department together. Foucault studies what he calls discourses, the discourse of sexuality. And he'll go into the archives of, you know, I don't know what that means, the archives, but this mysterious place with lots of documents. And he tries to figure out what are all the things that can be said in a certain time and place about, say, sexuality or about justice or about madness. What can you say? What are you allowed to say? What counts as something, right? Because there are certain things, I've discovered it. I discovered it in parenting, right? There are certain things I can say and not say, right? And there are certain things that if I say them, I risk not just being ostracized, ostracization, I risk jail, right? Because there's an entire discourse around what it is to parent, right? You cannot hit a kid. You cannot give a kid a shot of whiskey. Think about, 100 years ago, that was not a big deal. Did you all see There Will Be Blood by now? And he's constantly pouring his kid booze. Right? If I do that now, think about all the discourse that would rain down upon me, and you'd all say, but it's bad for the kid. And I'm saying, well, that's what you think is true. That's what the discourse says. And so doing and saying things outside of that discourse makes you insane. Right? There's a whole sort of bourgeois sentimentality around child rearing, about parenting, right? That I just don't really dig. Right? So when I say things like kids are vampires, right, you all kind of chuckle. People get a little nervous. Say this at the playground. Parents get really kind of nervous. Right? But you see it on their faces, right? They got big claw marks on their neck from their kid stealing their energy, stealing their life force. And the parents are like, but he's so lovely. I love parenting. I'm like, your kid might be lovely, but you don't love parenting. No one loves parenting. Parenting is horrible. It's a horrible, horrible practice. It doesn't mean I don't love my child. Yeah. Very hard for bourgeois discourse to understand this. I see you all trying to make sense of what the hell I'm talking about. You think a little bit, I'm insane. But that instinct, that moment right there is what I want you to see, that that's what defines a discourse. I say certain things, and that counts as insane or false or dangerous. Certain things can be said or not said. That's what Nietzsche claims truth is. Truth is the law that allows you to say things or not say things. Right? And so, I was going to talk about medicine as a good practice, right? A good discourse. In Western medicine, in the whole, I hate that phrase, but in the medical establishment, MDs, disease is viewed as a battlefield, right? I mean, the most common metaphor is probably war, right? Build up your defense system. Viruses everywhere. Kill them. Kill the germs. Right? Take it, right? And it's built on what is called allopathic medicine, right? Western medicine is allopathic versus homeopathic. Allopathic medicine, allo means other, right? Which means that you have a pathology and you fight it with something that's not that pathology. So you have you have bacteria, you take antibiotics. Seems really obvious, right? You take that all for granted that that's true. Right? Homeopathy treats like with like, right? From homo. Homo. Like with like, right? What homeopathy says is, first of all, there's no such thing as a disease. You don't have a disease. All you have are symptoms. It doesn't all trace back to a truth underneath the symptoms. You show certain signs, that's what your disease is. Does that make sense? Western medicine says all these things that are happening on the surface can all be traced back to something behind it, to a truth that exists elsewhere. Right? Okay, you're vomiting. That's just the symptom of the stomach flu or food poisoning. Sounds really obvious, right? But to the homeopath, that's not the case. They don't consider that true. You just are vomiting. But that's not quite right because there's all different kinds of vomiting. Do you vomit a lot? Do you vomit every 2 minutes? What does it look like? What does it feel like? Do other symptoms happen? And they consider everything. And then what they do is, rather than treat you with something outside of the pathology, they give you something to match the pathology, because they believe that symptoms are the body's doing its jobs. So what they do is give you a little tiny bit of something, tiny, 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 tiny bit of something that amplifies your symptoms, hurries them along. They believe the symptoms are your body's taking care of itself, right? So if you, have, lots of boogies, they give you something to give you more boogies, right? If you have, yeah.
What are boogies?
What are boogies? Fair enough.
And I'm sorry, I thought it was.
No. You know, if you have, I'm trying to think of a more explicit thing, and it gets very esoteric. But what counts as true to them is very different than what counts as true over here. And what's unbelievably frustrating is that you go to an MD, they treat all this other stuff so patronizingly. Like, well, you can try to see if it works. But they'll never recognize that there might be another truth, that everything they take for granted might be wrong. our assumption in the whole pharmaceutical industry is premised on, if you have a symptom, get rid of it. Right? Seems the obvious thing. But what's happening is we're getting sicker and sicker and dying quickly, right? And you've noticed that more and more in the U.S., we are actually dying younger and younger. Right? We can't sustain this life, right? Antibiotics don't work anymore. Homeopathy has a fundamentally different notion of what is true about your body and what's true about disease. There's a book, a good book, by Foucault's teacher, Georges Kinguiem, called, what the fuck's it called? The Normal and the Pathological. Thank you. In which he argues, he tries to look at the discourses, various medical discourses, and says, what, when you're sick, is it something that's discontinuous with you? Or is it you? Right? Is it a different state? Or is it part of you? Right? The TCM thing, right? The traditional Chinese medicine has a kind of homeopathic belief, right? But they do have a kind of cause. They think that everything that happens to you is from you and how your body goes in the world, right? So I saw this great, great acupuncturist, and he spent a long time diagnosing me. He's a great diagnostician. And at the end of which, he looks at me and he says something in Chinese, and then he goes, roughly that translates as, there is a great mist over your liver. And I was like, oh, man, that is so great, right? I was like, that's right, man. Go to these people, and they're like, ah, well, like, you know. The MD thing, man, is so insane. When you go to medical school, what do you study? What are you given to learn the body? Dead body. You get a cadaver. How insane is that? It's kind of like the left. Talk about nihilism. I'll learn about the healthy body by studying dead bodies. Right? It's completely insane. It's so obvious. It's not subtle. It's not like they're hiding their nihilism. So when you walk in a doctor's office, an MD, they treat you like a dead body. Right? They're annoyed that they have to talk to you at all. Right? Last time I went to an MD, because they still prescribe certain drugs I like, they have a little Palm Pilot. With a little decision tree, the same decision tree that's on WebMD. Right? You all go through it. You know before you go in there what it can be. This plus that equals this. This plus that equals that. And she didn't even look at me. She's like, okay, what happens? Okay, how do you feel? Okay, boom, there's a diagnosis. Never even looked at me. Go to my Chinese guy. He's like touching me, looking at me, talking. What happened in your whole past? He's trying to figure out your whole body. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Homeopath thing was very intense. And I just started going. This woman, very smart, cool woman. And I talked to her for 2 hours. I told her the deepest, darkest secrets, ma'am. I've never told anybody. And she looks down right there. She goes, not a big deal, you know. I won't tell you what she said, or what she diagnosed or prescribed. But they're fundamentally different truth systems. It's not that one is wrong. It's that they begin from a fundamentally different place. Each one is the center of the world. But what's fucking annoying about these guys is they speak patronizingly about these. And in fact, they initiate an entire legal apparatus, right? So if you buy any Chinese medicine, they all say on it, there are items in here that might be carcinogenic. It's a lie, right? But it was created by these doctors, afraid of these doctors. And because these guys are true, and these guys are outside the true and hence kind of wacky and insane, right? Yeah, they're going to give you cancer from their drugs. Yeah, Dana. You know, it's complicated, right? And sometimes these people can be very equally snobby and condescending, right? Sometimes they're cool and they're like, Everything in its place. What works, right? I went to this traditional Chinese guy, and he's like, you know, I tell him various things I'm doing from the allopathic world. He's like, does it work? And I was like, yeah. He's like, all right, let's keep it going, and for a while at least, let's see, until it doesn't work, right? Which is a different belief, right? You'd rather I probably not be doing it. And there are people I've run into who study so-called alternative medicine who are equally as pompous about what they do as these people. But you can see how pomposity arises. These people think it's just true. It's just true. You have a virus. Right? I had my MD tell me, you know, when I had a sinus infection, she's like, it cannot be cured except with antibiotics. It cannot. You have to take antibiotics. That is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. I will never go back to her. It was so stupid. Right? Because 1 week, boom, gone. Right? No problem, man. No problem to the homeopath. Much faster than antibiotics, a lot cheaper. It was this, but that's, they have no choice but to believe that. That is what is true to that MD. I don't pity her belief in her truth. What I pity her and what pisses me off is that she can't see outside of it. And it is why none of you should become doctors, because this will crumble quickly and is crumbling quickly, which I assume is all obvious to everybody, right? This industry is collapsing. You have a hand up?
Yeah.
It's incredibly esoteric, incredibly, right? So it's like little weird bits of something that somehow makes that thing, right? So, you know, if you have a certain kind of poisoning, they'll give you a tiny, homeopathic dose of arsenic, right? But one of the beliefs of homeopathy is the less there is of the thing, the more powerful. So you actually take these tiny little sugar pills that have infinitesimally tiny traces of the thing in it. So there's no risk. Nothing bad can happen. It just might not work. Because it wasn't right. It didn't actually amplify your symptom.
Are they placebos or they actually do have...
Yeah. No, it's a miracle. It's unbelievable. Don't buy the stuff. You can't just go and buy stuff for various reasons. You got to actually see somebody. And one of the aspects of I know of TCM, definitely of homeopathy, but I know more about Chinese medicine than allopathic medicine, is that they very explicitly approach diagnosis and treatment as an art. Because it's not obvious. And this always kind of freaks me out, right? You start giving your symptoms, and think about how much of communication between you and a doctor of any kind is based on what you tell them. Right? And the homeopaths are the wackiest because they want to know everything. Right, I remember I took my little boy, because these guys just failed miserably treating my boy's ear infections, right? And they classically have failed. And I hope you all know that, right? You should never take antibiotics for ear infections, but that's all they do. It's the only thing they can do. You go to see an MD, all they'll do is say, oh, ear infection, here's an antibiotic. You've got to be kidding me. They have no other alternatives. Not one thing. Right? It's bizarre. So the homeopath will call and go, okay, that didn't work. Let me ask you this. Is his head sweaty? Is his head sweaty near the ocean? Does he crave smoked fish? My homeopath asked me that. I thought she was Jew-baiting me. You like smoked? I was like, of course I like smoked fish. Right? But they try to put together a whole... And it's complicated because I have to say something back, and then I always panic. Did I say the wrong thing? Maybe his head is sweaty. Right? Which means that as the diagnostician, there is no right answer. It's all uncertain. It's all a negotiation and interpretation. They have to listen to what I'm saying. What's wrong with these people is they want your language to be transparent. Right? So you say, yeah, I got a headache. That means X, take an aspirin. As if what you said just gives way to the symptom. They don't actually listen to how you speak. It's not built into the practice. Well, for both of these people, the exchange with the patient is part of the process, is the art of treatment and diagnosis, not the science. These are fundamentally different worldviews, fundamentally different truths. Each one is the center of its own world, and in certain ways, it is impossible for them to speak to each other. They simply don't speak the same language. I say to the homeopath, yeah, I have a virus. You're like, huh? What's a virus? Doesn't mean anything to them. Literally, falls on dead ears. Nothing can happen. So that's what Nietzsche is telling us. That's what truth is. Truth is just what can be said and not be said. It's a whole world is constructed, right, around certain axes about what we can say and what we can't say, how we can talk about something. The liar is the person who uses the valid designations, the words, in order to make something which is unreal appear to be real. He says, for example, I am rich, when the proper designation for his condition is would be poor. He misuses fixed conventions by means of arbitrary substitutions and even reversals of names. This is precisely what Nietzsche is going to say is what the free intellect does. He uses that almost identical language 2 pages later. He's like the artist. That's what the artist does. He misuses fixed conventions by means of arbitrary substitutions or even reversals of names. Kind of like Nietzsche is doing here when he uses moral language to bash truth. Right? How does he say, when he says, you know, where did the honest drive for truth come from? What does the word honest mean in that context? Right? He's jamming the discourse. Right? He's coming at it and sort of using words in ways that don't quite fit the discourse. He's using their own words kind of against them. If he does this in a selfish and more of a harmful manner, society will cease to trust him and will thereby exclude him. But what men avoid by excluding the liar is not so much being defrauded as it is being harmed by means of fraud. Right? Which again, Nietzsche's entire way of looking at life, looking at the world, is by its effects. What are its effects? I don't care what you say is noble. What are the effects of it? So Nietzsche's saying here, right? It's not that people want the truth. It's not that they hate liars. It's that they don't want the harmful effects of liars. They don't actually care if you lie. But if you're, you know, start eating into their business, then they care. Right? If you start defrauding them of money or of their life or make them feel nervous or scared, then they care. They don't want those effects. Right? It's not the actual truth that they're interested in. What they care about are the effects. And that's how Nietzsche is going to read all of life. That is Nietzsche's entire practice. He looks at the effects. Right? I was watching a Dave Chappelle stand-up the other night. I've never seen him before. It was fucking hilarious. I guess it was a little old. He was talking about all the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton stuff. And I used to give this shtick. I used to talk about this in class, but now that Dave Chappelle talked about it, it makes it seem less obscene when I do it. But all of a sudden, right, you think that the news was actually talking about this case, right? They want to talk about this case. But it was really obvious to someone like me, clearly to Dave Chappelle, who doesn't vote, doesn't watch the news all that often. All of a sudden, it just seemed like an excuse for everyone to talk about, you know, blowjobs, right? All of a sudden, oral sex, oral sex, oral sex. And he talks about, you know, masturbating to the news. Because all of a sudden, the news became infused with this kind of pornographic element, right? Performatively, that's what was happening, right? There's someone told me about this in Oprah, where she was talking about, you know, like the rampant, the epidemic, was her word, epidemic of oral sex in high schools and middle schools. You know, right after this, we'll talk to a girl who gives oral sex in the bathroom. Right? It's kind of like the opening of NYPD Blue. She thinks she's coming out with this big thing covering the story, but of course there's a lurid element, a real perversity, a pleasure she's taking in talking about this, and that the audience is taking and watching it. They don't want to go rent porn, so they watch Oprah, and then all of a sudden with the news, you don't got to watch porn. Just turn on the news. They're talking about, you know, oral sex right then and there. They're talking about semen on dresses and cigars. I mean, they're talking about really explicit things, more explicit than a lot of porn, right on the news. So the news claims it's talking about this thing, but what they're performing, right, the effects of it, it's pornographic. Right? So when I'm watching Dave Chappelle, I'm like, that was a very rhetorical approach to the news. Right? Right? You always got to ask, whenever you see anyone claim to be talking about something, the question for the rhetorician, for Nietzsche, for the rhetorician always is, you know, what do you like about this? I was thinking about this cat sitting up in a tree, right? I noticed this. You guys were pointed out to me. I just saw it today, some cat sitting up in a tree. He might have some principle about it. You know what I'm talking about? There's some kid sitting up in a tree, I guess. You know, and I guess he has some principle. I don't know what it has to do with, but clearly, the question you have to ask is, what? This is someone who likes sitting in trees, right? and something about the sitting in trees. I guess something maybe he enjoys his own stench, right? Maybe he has to kind of enjoy pooping in a bucket, right? The point being that it's not just the principle, but the practice. Nietzsche will always return us to the practice. You can say, yes, I'm a noble man. I work with the, you know, the elderly. What do you do? I wipe their asses. Well, that's great. And so maybe your job is noble, but you're also a guy who wipes asses all day. And at some point, you have to be the person who likes wiping asses all day. Not that there's anything wrong with wiping asses all day, but then you're the person who likes wiping asses all day. That's what you do. The principle doesn't erase that. So at some point, the person who takes care of the elderly wiping their asses all day is a person who enjoys that. I have to assume that. Do you understand what I'm talking about? What are the effects? Not just what you say, but what do you perform? What is your life? What are the effects? The principle doesn't efface the experience. On the contrary, right? The experience comes first. That's Nietzsche's argument. Right, is in similarly restricted sense that man now wants nothing but truth. He desires the pleasant, life-preserving consequences of truth. He's indifferent towards pure knowledge, which has no consequences. Nietzsche will come back and hint at this notion of a pure knowledge, a pure will to truth, that is indifferent, inconsequential, cold, without categories, without knowledge. It is experience. It is experience bereft of concept and category. Right? Man doesn't want that kind of truth. The kind of brutality, the kind of indifference, the kind of chaos, right? We come up with natural laws, right? And then we say, isn't it strange that it's not obeying, that nature isn't obeying the laws? It's such a weird argument, right? And then there's sort of the audacity of many to say, well, we caused these weather changes. Well, maybe we did, I don't know. But it seems weird to say, you know, like I first moved to San Francisco, it never rained. It didn't rain once. It didn't rain once for like 5 years. It was pretty weird. Now it rains all the freaking time. Shit changes. What's the law? What's the law of the weather? Isn't this weird? I don't know what's weird. We make up a law to try to control the chaos, right? The indifference of nature. Nature just does what it wants to do. And then it deviates. We're like, it's not following the law. But how do we know what it's supposed to do? It just does what it does. So that doing what it does, that kind of indifference, Nietzsche keeps kind of alluding to here, right? It's not that kind of truth we want, because that's destructive. That's possibly harmful and destructive. And then, besides, what about these linguistic conventions themselves? Are they perhaps products of knowledge, that is, of the sense of truth? Are designations congruent with things? Is language the adequate expression of all realities? All right, so it is only by means of forgetfulness that man can ever reach the point of fancying himself to possess a truth of the grade just indicated. And we'll come back to forgetfulness. We'll talk about it in some detail, as he does. If he will not be satisfied with truth in the form of tautology, what is tautology? This is something you should leave this class knowing, Diana. Yeah. We use the thing to define it, right? So you say, you know, the famous one is from Molière, right? So, you know, a doctor comes and says, you know, the guy's freaking out. He gives him a sleeping pill. Wife says, how does a sleeping pill work? He says, well, it has a, you know, what's the word? It's a soporific, right? Yeah, it has a soporific effect. What does soporific mean? It means it puts you to sleep, right? Or you say, someone give me another example. It's using the thing itself to define it rather than the thing being defined outside itself. Yeah.
If you can't find what you're looking for, you're not looking in the right place.
Yeah. Let's think about that. If you're if you can't find what you're looking for. Oh yeah. It kind of defines itself, is that right? Help me guys, I'm tired. Is that right?
I mean because the only way you would be looking in the right place is if you could find what you're looking for.
Yeah. I suppose so.
Right.
Right. Yeah. All right. So tautology is when you use the thing to define itself, right? Nietzsche is going to claim here that all knowledge is tautologic, right? Which means that, you know, we'll talk about a stone. We say stones are hard. Right? As if we know hardness from someplace other than stones. Well, there's no pure experience of hard. We only know what hard is because of the stone. Isn't that stone hard? What does hard mean? Hard means being hit with a stone. You know, when something has the consistency of a stone, that's what hard is. How can I say the stone is hard? Right? Knowledge just refers to itself. It is a self-construing system. And again, for Nietzsche, that is not a problem. He doesn't have a problem with tautology. But when he says that's tautologic, to men of science, nothing is worse than tautology. Tautology is the ultimate criticism, because then you haven't actually said anything about the world. You've just defined, you haven't gone anywhere else. Tautology is circular. You haven't made a claim about the world. You've just built your own little system here that works only for your little system. And for Nietzsche, tautology, no problem. Everything's tautological. But when he says it here, it functions as a critique. It functions as a critique of logic. Does that make sense? We'll talk about it again. It comes up a few times. What is a word? It is the copy and sound of a nerve stimulus. But the further inference from the nerve stimulus to a cause outside of it is already the result of a false and unjustifiable application of the principle of sufficient reason. Truth alone had been the deciding factor in the genesis of language. And if the standpoint of certainty had been decisive for designations, then how could we still dare to say the stone is hard, as if hard was something otherwise familiar to us and not merely a total subjective stimulation? We separate things according to gender, designating the tree as masculine and the plant as feminine. What arbitrary designations! How far this oversteps the canons of certainty. We speak of a snake. This designation touches only upon its ability to twist itself and could therefore also fit a worm. What arbitrary differentiations! What one-sided preferences, first for this and then for that property of a thing. The various languages placed side by side show this. Okay? This is important, and this will be easy to understand. That's the moon. Right. What is la lune? Oh, French, yeah. What is Spanish would be la luna, right? What does moon mean, and what does luna mean? What does moon mean? Anyone know? It's pretty obscure. I don't really know etymologically, but it comes from like mensis, like menstruation, which is cyclical, right? It's something that comes back cyclically, right? What does la lune come from? What do you think it means? Huh? Light. Light. Right? So look at this. Here's this thing called the moon. Well, it's called the moon to me. But you have two different people. One guy is standing in Oklahoma. And there's this big honking thing up in the sky. It's night, but there's this big thing up there. He doesn't know what to call it. Big light. Doesn't know. I don't know what the hell it is. Goes home. Notices that over time, every day it comes up an hour later. Right? And keeps changing. Keeps shrinking and growing. Shrinking and growing. It seems to be cyclical. Finally, he's like, you know what? That thing's cyclical. That's what I'm going to call it. The cycle. The moon. That's what he sees. He looks up there and he sees the cyclical nature of the moon. Some Frenchie is hanging out, looks up there, the light! Doesn't really take time, much more passionate, right? Light, I love the light! Okay. They both designate this thing, the moon, but there are different preferences. A word doesn't just give you the whole thing. A word, like I told you on the first day, is an argument. A word stands towards a thing argumentatively. It doesn't just designate that thing. It makes an argument about what it is. And what Nietzsche, in fact, is going to say, he's going to say that first moment, that preference is a beautiful moment. The man who looks up there and goes, moon, is beautiful. That's art. That's poetry. It's a metaphor, yes. It's an arbitrary preference for one thing over another, yes. But that's all we have. That's beautiful. That's what art is. Art is the celebration of the arbitrary, the celebration of the subjective, of the perspective. Yes, to me, that is light. I love the light. The problem is, from now on, all of you have to say it's light. Or in our case, it's the moon. It's the moon. If you call it something else, you're wrong. And in fact, you don't even need to look up at it and experience it anymore. Why? Because we got a word for it. That's the moon. Right? But to the creative person, every time you look up at that, it's a little bit different. You could picture if you're like a cat burglar, right? And all of a sudden that moon's up there, you'd be like, you rat devil, you're ratting me out. Right? You're shining light, I'm trying to be sneaky here. Right? Or you might look at your sweetie and say, oh, the moon is like your eyes. The point being that there's no difference. It is a one-sided preference. The moon is no more true than saying the moon is your eyes. Okay? It is a poetic moment. It is a creative moment in which you designate one a metaphor. You can't get the thing itself. What would the thing itself be? What word would designate every aspect? Well, it's cyclical and moon, and it's kind of like your eyes, and it's going to change day to day, your relationship to that moon. It's circumstantial. So what Nietzsche gives us is the possibility of a world that privileges that circumstance and says, you know what? Every time I look up there, it's different. Every time. Today, oh, it is my sweetie's eyes. It is a rat devil. It is a piece of cheese. It is, you know, a mini sun. It is, think of all the different things you might be able to call it and how much it's going to change day to day depending on your circumstance. But truth, Nietzsche tells us, truth is the law that says we will all call it the moon. To call it something else is wrong. Right? So in school, you know, the little kids all sit down in their little desks and we say, today we're going to learn the planets. That's the moon, that's the sun. And one kid in the class is going to raise his hand and go, the what? Moon? No. My dad calls that, you know, my mommy's eyes. And the teacher's going to go, that's wrong. Really? Right? And now the kids will be brought in line. And all of a sudden you can see knowledge becomes this vehicle of power. Right? It becomes related to the law. That's what he says, to law and morality. We will all do this. We will all follow this prescription. All do this. All call it the moon. Don't call it something else. Don't call it the light.
Vince? You said that it becomes a vehicle of power. Isn't it always a vehicle?
Good. Thank you. Good qualification. Yes. Yeah, so not that it becomes a knowledge, but it's in our shifting. The becoming was shifting worldviews.
Okay.
Right. Fair, right? So knowledge is always and already a vehicle of power. That's what he's going to tell us, right, on the bottom of 84. It's going to be, knowledge becomes this thing that creates hierarchies and laws. That's what the truth and language and their conspiracy together do. Right? So for Nietzsche, poetry is not this thing that's extra, this ornament. But everything is always already poetic. The problem is certain people are crappy poets. And they don't want to be poets, so they just want to follow someone else's poetry, so they just copy them. So some great poet looked up in the sky. And the person who called this the moon was pretty cool. Right? What a weirdo. Right? Light I get. Right? It seems pretty obvious. But to call it the moon, you really have to take some time. At least 3 months, right? Because 3 is a series. You have to always wonder on the fourth one, maybe it's going to do something different now, and it's not cyclical at all. See what I'm saying? It's a fundamentally different person. Fundamentally different person looked up and called that the moon than the person who looked up there and called it the light. Both those people are artists, but very different. Very different relationships to life.
A coin, a word is originally a metaphor.
Yes.
But through time and usage, we forget that original
Good.
Poetic meaning.
Perfect.
So none of us, or most of us probably don't think of Menzies when we say the moon.
Right.
But that's at the origin of the word itself.
Very good, right? And so that's why Nietzsche says in order to have truth, it is based on forgetfulness. We have to forget that original poetic moment. We have to forget that that designation of a word is in fact an arbitrary preference, an arbitrary moment, a subjective moment. Right? In order to believe in the truth, we have to forget that we are creative. We have to forget the origin of the word. And it's one reason I love the OED. The OED is a hilarious, beautiful book, right? Because it's etymologically obsessed. You know what I'm talking about, the Oxford English Dictionary? Right? When I do 1A, 1B, the first assignment was always, you got to go look up a word in the OED. Should I make that an assignment? You should go look up a word in the OED. I think it's all online, isn't it? I have one of the ones, you know, when I need a magnifying glass. It's annoying. But they love to trace a word, and it's hilarious to watch. And so nothing becomes definitive. You just get this kind of splaying of a word's history. And they always give uses from that time. And so it's beautiful. It's a strange kind of dictionary. The various languages placed side by side show that with words, it is never a question of truth, never a question of adequate expression. Otherwise, there would not be so many languages. Duh. Right? What you're getting are these proliferations of truth systems, these proliferations of arbitrary designations of things. A word is an argument. Right? A word is a preference for something. A word is an amplification or a de-amplification of certain qualities of that thing. Right? I mean, I always laugh, you know, to call me a man means to forget and ignore a lot of things I do. You know, I cross my legs funny, you know, I pee sitting down, there are all kinds of things. Right? What? And that's, you know, this, if those of you who've studied with Judith Butler, know Judith Butler at all in the department, she has a whole theory of gender. Gender is performative. It doesn't come back to a fixed person who you are. You perform different things. I perform femininity, I perform masculinity, do all kinds of, right? It's to say, no, you're just a man, is to forget all the differences. Might have been a severe simplification of Judith Butler, but. Yeah. You're just nodding, stretching. the thing itself, which is precisely what pure truth, apart from any consequences, would be, is likewise something quite incomprehensible to the creator of language and something not in the least worth striving for. So when I'm trying to name something, it's not that I have to try to capture the essence of the thing. It's not worth striving for. My relationship to the thing needs to be more poetic, more creative, more argumentative. Right? Don't try, you know, think about trying to name the moon in all of its, you know, absolutely. You would be an infinite process, literally infinite. And the word would become infinite. For those of you who've read Borges has a great little short story in the middle of which he discovers a world within a world and there's a language within that world. And that's, they describe things only in adjectives. There's no noun. Things are only adjectival impressions. And they become quite long. Right? Think about how you're going to describe the room. Brown, square, kind of hot, no windows, right? It become a lot of adjectives. I guess those are too many nouns in there, but you get the idea. The Creator only designates the relations of things to men, and for expressing this relations, he lays hold of the boldest metaphors. This is it. This is the argument, man. This is it right here. When you're only ever designating a relationship. You're not getting the truth. It's how you stand towards something. It is your perspective. It is a relationship. And this is what rhetoric is obsessed with. Rhetoric is obsessed with these interactions. Right? Not with pure truth, but with interactions between things, effects and relationships. You stand towards this in a certain way, certain perspective. Right? And what you designate is a relationship. Not the truth, but a relationship. And the way you do that, again, is you lay hold what he calls the boldest metaphors. Right? So you look up at this. There's no way to name it, so you name something else. Oh, it's light. And, of course, light comes from something else. Right? It would be the dictionary, this endless kind of deferral of meaning. Right? Everything references everything else. And it's constantly getting mishmashed together and put back together in these impossible ways. What science tries to do, and he'll go on to tell us, is to try to structure it all. Put everything in its place and make a fixed structure. That will always be the moon. Right? That will always be a river. Right? That will always be land. You'll always be a man. You'll always be a woman. Right? I was watching this morning on YouTube A little quick video on a leech. I guess leeches are hermaphroditic. So the guy's talking, goes, he, she, it. And what you immediately see right there is that language limits how we can think about gender. You're out of the he, she, or it. But it didn't seem right at all. It seems kind of cold for that poor leech. Right? But he or she didn't work either. Right? And so you can see that when your language is limited, how you're able to talk and think about things is limited by those things. Language is a kind of law. Not just what you can say, but what you can think. All right, how are we doing here? I got a couple minutes. Woohoo! It'd be great if we get through this paragraph. So to begin with, a nerve stimulus is transferred into an image. First metaphor, this image in turn is imitated in a sound. Second metaphor, and each time there's a complete overlapping of one sphere right into the middle of an entirely new and different one. Right? So, you know, something happens, and some word comes to you, and then you got to make a sound, and there's another word, and you're constantly removed from the thing itself. You're never going to capture the thing itself. You're never going to capture the truth of the world. Right? And that might be kind of a familiar argument, right? The sort of impossibility of actually capturing the truth. But Nietzsche's move is not just that we can't capture the truth. He's like, yeah, we can't capture the truth. Woohoo! It's not a failure of man. The failure of man is to think that we did capture the truth. Right? The fact that we can't capture the truth is a liberation, man. Is a liberation. Is a will to art and creation. Right? So there'll be other philosophers who will say, we can't get the thing itself. Immanuel Kant, we can't get at the thing itself. We're trapped in our subjectivities. We can't really get there. And Nietzsche's like, yeah, that's right. That's right. Ain't it cool? That's the whole move he makes. Right? The very problem that people have with life and with knowledge, he doesn't see as a problem. He doesn't try to figure it out. If you read the whole history of philosophy and epistemology, they're all trying to figure out, how can I know what this is? It's there and I'm here. And the entire history of epistemology, if you take philosophy classes, will give you these insane arguments about how I can know that. And Nietzsche comes along and goes, you can't know it. Who cares? Make something up. Right? It's a fundamentally different move, and kind of a beautiful move. Look at the last line on that paragraph on 83, right? Because thus the genesis of language does not proceed logically in any case. And all the material within and with which the man of truth, the scientist and the philosopher later work and build, if not derived from Never Never Land, is at least not derived from the essence of things. Right, so just this one swift move. Philosophers, scientists, all you people who think you're talking about the world, maybe you're talking about Never Never Land. Which is kind of beautiful, right? Because that would be another kind of mythology. He's like, either way, you ain't talking about the world. So what are you doing? All right, so the next thing gets more complicated. So, I'm going to hand out. That's all. But wait one second, because I'm going to hand out your midterm assignments. All right, hold up.